Well, I guess we're about ready to get started here. We're a little bit late, but welcome to the first National Reptile and Amphibian Advisory Council Reptile and Amphibian Law Symposium. I know it's a little bit early for you guys. It's way early for me, and I don't do suits very well, so I may end up losing the jacket, the tie, the shirt. I'll try to keep the pants on, though. I think everybody would appreciate that. We got a lot of ground to cover, not much time to do it. Each of the topics that we've chosen today and tomorrow could easily fill a room for an entire day and still not cover everything that needs to be covered. Reptile and amphibian laws are going to be with us for the next 100 years, 200 years, 300 years, and there's going to be more of them. Not less. That's just the nature of the beast. So I think that this is a good start in sitting down and maybe working towards some solutions towards some of the issues that we see coming up over the next 10 and 20 years. I've brought some interesting people here to talk to you. The very first one this morning is Sue Jewell from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She's got a presentation on invasive species and injurious wildlife. That's probably going to be the biggest topic that we're going to be facing over the next 20 years. Invasive species are an issue. They're not just a Florida issue. They're a Texas issue, too. They're a California issue. If you go out at night on my porch, you'll count 20 or 30 Mediterranean geckos. Not native to this state, but they're all over the place. So with that, Sue, you want to take over?
All right, first a little adjustment here. A big adjustment, okay. Everybody can hear me? All right. Thank you, Jeff, and everybody for inviting the Fish and Wildlife Service. We're always glad to have an opportunity to come and explain what we do and make sure that everybody understands that there's nothing hidden. There's no hidden agendas in what we do, and so I'm here to explain things and answer questions. So I prepared this PowerPoint presentation because I noticed that the questions that Jeff had posed on the internet and had sent to all the panelists, a lot of them had to do with things that only Fish and Wildlife Service and Injurious Wildlife person could answer, and it seemed like it made more sense to just put them all together, answer them in one fell swoop, and then from there we have more time for discussion. So I may take more than my 10 or 15 or even 20 minutes, I don't know.
I don't have a watch.
But
so
yeah,
really.
I was just going to say, if people aren't interested, you can cut me off. But I think that you will find it interesting because it's something that a lot of people don't know about. We've been listing things as injurious since 1952, and even when I worked in the Fish and Wildlife Service, before I came to work in injurious wildlife, I had heard of it, but I didn't even really know much about it. So it's understandable, but we're trying to spread the word now so people understand what it is, especially with our new rule to list the Burmese python and the other species. There were a lot of misconceptions. I do want to mention that there's a fact sheet that's out on the registration table. If you haven't gotten one, please be sure to pick one up. And we're going to try this strange remote control that's called a mouse and see if I can work the controls from here.
So, we have a remote control as well.
Oh, wait. All right. Okay. Real technology. All right, so this would be... First, what I'm going to do is to explain how we list as injurious, what things we've listed, explain the process, and a few extra things thrown in.
We hope it works.
Hang on. In the meantime, yeah. Okay, we know this works. Okay. All right, we'll see if it works. Sorry for that. Okay, first, a lot of this panel discussion is supposed to be on invasive or injurious with some no distinction between the two. And the question is, what is the difference? And I wanted to start off by saying, what is the difference? What do we mean by invasive species versus injurious wildlife? So I have this little schematic, and it's just to show you. Oh, okay. To show you a tortoise or whatever that was. What this is showing you, invasive species is a broad set of plants and animals. And injurious wildlife is a smaller subset of that. And you'll notice that it's not a subset completely within invasive species. It actually goes out, I don't know if it says, yeah, pointer, goes out a little bit. Excuse me, while I do some adjustment. Okay, good. Oh, I like this much better. I like to move around. Okay, so you'll see that there's a little bit outside invasive species. Injurious wildlife is a regulatory term. It's very specific, and it just has to do with the definition under the Lacey Act, which the next slide has. Injurious wildlife, which is just wildlife and not plants, can also be species that are not necessarily invasive. They are injurious in some other way. For example, there could be snakes that are venomous that even if they escape and don't establish, they can still do great harm. They can be injurious. Or something that carries a disease, and the disease isn't really invasive, but it's a disease, that can be considered injurious too. So there's a little bit that is outside the realm of invasive species. But for the most part, what we're talking about with injurious wildlife usually is invasive species. And the definition, let me see, there's a definition from Executive Order 13112, which is for invasive species, which is an alien species whose introduction does or is likely to cause economic or environmental harm or harm to human health. And on the next slide, okay, we're going to the mouse. No, we're not. Okay.
Yeah, that's another power. Here, let me see the mouse. That's I'll cue you up here. I don't know how we got onto that already.
Well, the that's a good one. Okay.
It's really odd. Okay.
Okay, it's that one. Okay.
I'll work this, you talk.
Okay, sure, thanks. So this is the definition under the Lacey Act, which is where injurious wildlife falls. Wildlife found in regulation or professional action to be injurious to the interests of human beings, agriculture, horticulture, forestry, wildlife, or wildlife resources of the United States. And notice, I think this part still works. Good, okay. See this Lacey Act 18. I'm going to be talking a little bit more about that, and then I'm going to tell you the difference between Title 18 and Title 16, and there's a very important difference that I want to make that distinction on. So, next. Okay, so what I want to do here is explain the difference between two parts of the Lacey Act. And this is important because there's been a lot of confusion about whether if you violate the injurious wildlife provisions, you can become a felon. And so this is how I'm going to explain it. The Lacey Act was passed in 1900 by Congressman Lacey in Iowa. And he had two big issues that were happening in the United States at that time. And they were related to wildlife, but they weren't that similar. He put them into the same act. So there are two separate parts of it. And one of them has to do with, at the time, people were bringing in things like
the European starling and the house sparrow from England, because somebody wanted to have all the birds that Shakespeare had in his homeland, and they wanted to have them in the United States. So they were intentionally brought in, and they subsequently established and did great harm to agricultural crops. They eat seeds and crops. So that was a problem, and some other species were being brought in too. And there was another thing going on that was affecting wildlife in the United States, and that was people were starting to market hunt, and they were hunting something like, let's say, passenger pigeons in one state and bringing them to another state and selling them. And then the state where they were hunted would pass a protective law, but once those passenger pigeons were brought to another state, that other state's law didn't have any effect. So Congressman Lacey wanted there to be some way to respect the laws of the original state where that law was passed. So he wanted some interstate prohibitions. So there are two parts. There's the introduction of these injurious species, and then there's this marketing, trafficking, interstate part. So this part right here, Title 16, is the very, very broad part of the Lacey Act, which covers all kinds of regulations. I'll just read it. Gives assistance to states with intercepting illegal importation and interstate transport of wildlife species and plants taken or possessed in violation of state, federal, or tribal or foreign laws. I'm not going to get too much into this because Jim Hampton is going to be here later and he's going to discuss this more. But this is very broad. It includes anything that is prohibited or protected. So it can include Endangered Species Act. It can cover CITES. It can cover injurious wildlife. It can cover a state law, a tribal law, a foreign country's law. It can cover dead or alive plants or animals. And the penalties for this do include felons. They are felony laws, or whatever you call it, violations. So there's one set of penalties for this. What I work under is the injurious wildlife provision, which is this one, Title 18. And all that does is give us the authority to put something on a list, and that would prohibit its importation and interstate transportation. And what we can put on the list does not include plants, does not include parts, does not include possession or sale or anything like that. So they're two very different things. And the penalties for injurious wildlife violations are misdemeanors. They're not felonies, okay? The complication can be if you do something on top of simply importing, like you're going to sell it, or you're conspiring, you've got two people involved, or something like that. If there's a complication, that can bump it up to the Title 16 violation. Okay. And any other questions about that, probably we should save that for the section on the law. Okay, next. Okay, so I want to make it clear what the Title 18 injurious wildlife provisions do. Prohibits importation, prohibits interstate transportation, and it can include dead species or dead individuals. We have only done this so far for salmonids, salmon species, because they carry diseases that can wipe out our salmon populations. And so, okay, thanks. So if they're eviscerated, they don't have their guts in them, then it's okay, you can import them. Or if they're accompanied by a health certificate saying that they don't have these diseases, you can import dead salmonids. So there are exceptions where you can import injurious species. These are for scientific, educational, medical, or zoological purposes, and you would need to get a permit through the Fish and Wildlife Service. And we're going to have more about that later. But I do want to stress that injurious wildlife species, you are allowed to possess them, you are allowed to sell them, you are allowed to use them. You can move them within the state. So under this federal law, you can do all that. Now, you're probably all aware that there can be state laws, there can be other jurisdictional laws, like a city or county law, that tells you otherwise. But all New Jersey wildlife provisions do is to prevent importation and interstate transportation. Okay, next. Okay, so who implements the injurious wildlife provisions? My branch does the evaluations, and we write the rules, and we give them to the secretary for approval. The Office of Law Enforcement enforces the regulations, and we have several people, Jim Hampton and Brad Williams, will be here in the next panel to talk about that. And the Division of Management Authority handles the requests for permits. And we have Amnera Siaka will be talking about that. And also Craig Cooper will be talking about importations and things like that later. Okay, next. So this next one is going to be kind of weird because I'm going to compare injurious wildlife to endangered species listings. And the reason I'm doing this is because I came from Endangered Species Listing Program, and I was working on listing things as threatened or endangered. When I switched over to injurious wildlife, and I started talking to people, and I was listening to what they were saying to me and the questions that they were asking, it seemed to me that they understood the concept of listing something, probably because they were familiar with endangered species. And they were trying to wrap their heads around, well, how does this work for injurious wildlife? And so I decided to do a side-by-side comparison and show that there are a lot of similarities, but there are also a lot of differences. When I came to injurious wildlife, I went temporarily. I was just being borrowed to help set up this program because the process of the regulatory process is the same. You still have to go through the proposed rule, and you put it out for public comment, and you review the comments and things like that. And so all of this is the same. The difference is the standards that we use and the criteria that we use to evaluate the species. So I'm going to see how this works. I've got some little animation here. So let's go to the first one. Let's do the second one, too. Okay. So the injurious wildlife provisions are under the Lacey Act. Endangered species is under the Endangered Species Act. Okay. Do the next two. The Lacey Act was enacted in 1900 and the Endangered Species Act in 1973. So in 1900, Congress was a little bit less experienced in passing laws, and this was the first national wildlife law. So it was pretty general. In 1973, the Endangered Species Act was passed, and Congress gave a lot of instructions to the authorizing agencies. So the actual act is about 41 pages long for Endangered Species Act, but for us, we have about a page of instructions. So there's that difference. Okay, next two. The authority for the Lacey Act was given to the Department of the Interior. Actually, originally in 1900, it was the Department of Agriculture. The Fish and Wildlife Service didn't exist then, so agriculture was given lots of authorities. We got the authority around 1940 when the Fish and Wildlife Service was created. But under the Endangered Species Act, the authority for listing is given to two different departments, Department of the Interior and the Department of Commerce. Department of Commerce can list the marine species. So under NOAA fisheries, they can list the marine species. This has been a little bit source of confusion too, because people assume that because endangered species can be listed by NOAA fisheries, that injurious wildlife can be listed by NOAA fisheries. And so somebody had asked NOAA fisheries if they could list the lionfish as injurious, and they said, no, you have to talk to the Fish and Wildlife Service for that. So, okay, next two. This is the difference in what we can list as injurious and what endangered species can list. We can list wild mammals and wild birds. Notice it says wild, not domesticated, but we can list any reptile, amphibian, or fish. And those are all in the vertebrate classes. For invertebrates, we can only list two categories, which are the mollusks and crustaceans. We can't list insects, we can't list annelids or things like that. We don't have the authority for that. Department of Agriculture can list pest insects, and so they do have some authority over that. We cannot list any plants. This is just injurious wildlife. For endangered species, it can be any wildlife species or any plant species. Okay, next two. And here's a big difference. Under the Lacey Act, it says, I'm kind of paraphrasing here for simplicity, the secretary may list. That means the secretary has discretion. The secretary can, we can do an evaluation, and if it says something's injurious, the secretary can, for various reasons, decide not to do it. For endangered species, the secretary has to. If a species is evaluated and is found to meet the definition of threatened or endangered, then we're supposed to list it. And that's why we get sued a lot, because somebody claims that they think something should meet the definition and we haven't listed it. So that's a big difference. Next two, please. Okay, we don't have any statutory deadlines. Endangered Species Act does. And that's another reason that we get sued under endangered species if we don't meet a deadline. But fortunately, that can't happen in injurious wildlife. Okay, next two. All federal agencies do their regulations under the Administrative Procedures Act, and we're no different. Under the Lacey Act, that's what we do. Under Endangered Species Act, they also follow the APA. However, under Endangered Species Act, like I said, Congress gave them a lot more instructions. So Congress can change things and tell an agency something different. And so Congress has given statutory deadlines and a bunch of other things to endangered species that are not under the injurious wildlife listing provisions. And I think there's one more. Okay, so we have to do all the required determinations. We have to do an economic analysis. We have to do the NEPA. Under endangered species, they only have to list based on the biology of the species and the biological need. And so they don't do an economic analysis for listing. They do for critical habitat designation. And they have a categorical exclusion to not do an environmental assessment. Okay, next one. Okay, these are the species that have been listed as injurious. The grand total is about 234. It's a little hard to give the exact number of species because we've listed in some cases an entire family, and there may be some taxonomic changes in those families, but, you know, a splitting of one species into two species. So we're using a number of 234. The first species at the very top, you'll see those were listed by Congress when the act was passed. There's a big gap there, and I deliberately left a gap to show that there was nothing listed until 1952. And that means, actually, that the Department of Agriculture never listed anything as injurious, because by then, by 1952, we were the ones doing the listing. So there are a variety of things, such as raccoon dog and brush-tailed possum, that we listed before they ever became a problem in the United States. So we have listed things proactively. There's some other examples, I'm not going to go into them, but we have done some things. I know we've been accused of, like, the Burmese python, well, it's too late. We did start trying to do it a long time ago. So there's a mixture of things that we didn't get to in time, and things that we did get to in time, because as of now, there's no raccoon dogs or brush-tailed possums problems in the United States. And of course, the one you're probably all most interested in is the Burmese python, northern and southern African python, and the yellow anaconda, which we listed in January, took effect in March. Okay, thank you. So I know this slide is very crowded, but it's the listing process, so I do want to show it to you. It's the same process that's used for all types of regulations under the Administrative Procedure Act. We start with an unevaluated tax on. Now, if we don't have a lot of information, we can do this first step, which is optional. It's a notice of inquiry that we publish in the Federal Register, and we ask the public for more information. We did that with the Burmese python and some of the other species. So, but if we do have enough information, and very often we do, we can put a good proposed rule together without going out for a notice of inquiry. Then we will do the proposed rule, which is published in the Federal Register. It gets a comment period, usually 60 days, and it goes out for peer review. Our peer review process follows the OMB process, which is Office of Management and Budget, and that's the process that we follow. We post our peer review plan on the internet for everybody to see. For this NAGRE rule, we didn't get any comments on that. So this is all a very open process. Then we evaluate the comments, both from the peer reviewers and the public. They do a revision if that's required. We can do either two things. We can withdraw the proposed rule, or we can finalize the rule, which may be slightly different or very different from the proposed rule. So that's about it. And next slide, please. Okay, so I know this slide is a little crowded too, but I want to show you that we use certain criteria for how we list something as injurious. We look at the factors that contribute to being considered injurious, which include things like it's a likelihood of release or escape. For example, an example that I use a lot because, and I'll use it here because it involves a constrictor snake. If you have two types of pets, one is a gerbil, and when it's purchased in the pet store, it's small and harmless, and you know what it eats, it just eats a little bit, and you know exactly, it's small and harmless, but a few years later, when it's full grown, it's still small and harmless, and it eats pretty much the same thing. And because it only lives for a few years, chances are your child's attention span is probably about gone by then, and it's not a problem. If you purchase a Burmese python as a hatchling, it's small, it's cute, doesn't eat a lot, and it's pretty harmless. But 20 years later, it's a different animal. It's 200 pounds, it can be 20 feet long. The child has long since gone, and the parents are left with it, and what are they going to do with it? So we see this as greater likelihood of it either escaping or being dumped because it's so different from the original animal. So that's just a little example of what we're looking at. So its ability to survive, establish, to spread, the impacts on wildlife, threatened and endangered species, forestry, agriculture, things like that. But we also look, on the other hand, at factors that reduce the likelihood of being injurious. So is there a way that we could prevent the escape of that animal so that we're sure that it won't become the basic problem? Is there a way that we could, and I'm using we in the royal sense in general, perhaps only sell one gender so they can't reproduce, or sterilize them so they can't reproduce? Or is the problem that they're carrying a disease, maybe we can control the disease? So we do look at those things. And we also, ecological benefits to introduction means something like a biological control. So we also look at that. Is a barn species going to do more good than harm? Next. Okay, I threw this slide in. I'm pretty much done talking about injurious wildlife listing process. I threw this one in because I was pretty sure there would be some interest in this. We received a petition from the Defenders of Wildlife in 2009 to list all amphibians as injurious unless they're accompanied by a health certificate saying they're free of BD, Trichocytrium dendrobatitis, and chytrid fungus. I have been fully working on that ever since. Obviously, listing an entire class of animals is something way beyond anything we've ever done before. And we know that it's impractical. We are looking at various options. We and the petitioners want to prevent the spread of ED. So right now, we put out a notice of inquiry looking for more information. We reviewed the comments. We actually got more questions than we got answers to. It's a very complex subject, so I just want to say we want to respond to the defender's petition. We want to help to protect amphibians against ED, but we have to come up with the best way. And it could be that it takes people like you doing good sterile processes and keeping your breeding colonies clean and things like that. It could take help from everybody for that. Okay, next. Okay, I'm going to do this one really quickly. Keep clicking. Okay, that's okay. These are some similarities between the Endangered Species Act and the Lacey Act. One of them is that listing is expensive, and it comes from taxpayer dollars. So we're aware of that. We're aware that there are good reasons not to list. And another one is that whenever we list something, some people are really happy about it, some people are not happy about it, and we don't want people to not be happy. So this is another reason. We like to try to find other ways that so that we don't have to list something as either endangered or injurious. And the next one, by the time we list, because the process takes a while, it can be too late. So we do need to try to all help prevent problems. Okay, next one. Okay, and continue. Okay, I did want to focus one slide on how you can help. We are, at this time, back in my office, doing some risk assessments for aquatic species, mostly fish, doing risk assessments, kind of rapid screens, to determine which are high-risk species and which are low-risk species. We're doing this in conjunction with a request from PJAC, Pet Industry Joint Advisory Council, who came to us, and Marshall Myers, who had come to the realization that the pet industry needed to take more responsibility and not just import every kind of species, that there were species like the Burmese python, which was introduced for the pet trade, that could become problems in the United States, and that there could be a way, if the industry knew which was the low-risk species, that they would have this choice and be able to make responsible choices. And so we are working with Marshall Myers from PJAC on doing risk assessments. And right now we're doing them for fish because a lot of people import fish for aquariums. And we've actually posted on our internet site high-risk species and some low-risk species now. I think we only have one. To give people a choice and informed choice in which species they can use, they can focus on, and to try to help us to avoid problems. We haven't done this for any reptile or amphibian yet, but it can be done. So, the next one, support responsible pet ownership. I don't really need to explain that. And the next one, create and support. Click one more time. Okay. I want to emphasize, we all need to let everybody know that they should not ever release any unwanted pet into the wild. One more slide. Okay, right there. We have a national campaign. The Fish and Wildlife Service is working with PJAC and NOAA Fisheries on this campaign to help educate the public on why they shouldn't release things into the wild and what their alternatives are. So hopefully everybody can make use of this. It hasn't quite focused yet on reptiles and amphibians. It's mostly on the aquatic species of fish. But I'm not sure there's plans to broaden it to reptiles too. Okay, and that's it. And I hope I haven't taken too much time. There should be enough time for discussion.
Plenty of time for discussion, okay. Sue.
Thank you.
Thank you. If the panelists would like to go ahead and come on up, we can start asking some questions. The panelists are going to get an opportunity to ask questions first, and then if we have time, we'll release more questions to the audience. And after this, We're going to have a breakout session. If you have more questions, you'll be able to speak with Sue and some of the other panelists over in the breakout room. The breakout rooms are room 3 and 4, all the way down at the end of the hall and to the left. Who are we missing up here?
We'll be back in the room in just a minute.
Okay. I think it was...
I see that.
There we go. Sue, I got to tell you, I didn't know 98% of the stuff that was in your program. So that was very informative. I learned quite a bit. Your sign is down. Sue, let me go ahead and start off with the first question. It's probably one that is on a lot of people's minds in here. I know that once you put an animal on the endangered species list, there are mechanisms in place to have it come off should it become no longer an endangered species. What about an injurious species? Are there methods in the injurious species program to have an animal delisted from being injurious?
Yes. Can you all hear me? Yes. Okay. And it's the same process, basically. We don't have to be petitioned. We could be petitioned. The same process under endangered species.
I'm going to move this down so we can record it a little better.
Under the Administrative Procedure Act, we can do the same thing in reverse. We can do an evaluation of a species, and if we determine from the evaluation that there's no need to have it listed anymore, then we can delist it. The thing is, it's a different circumstance for endangered species than for injurious wildlife. Once the species is taken off the endangered species list, it is actually monitored for 5 years after that. And there has to be a pretty good guarantee that it's not going to be back on the endangered species list anytime. For injurious wildlife, there's no way to guarantee that. A species could still be imported, and it's a different circumstance. So while the answer to the question is yes, you can take something off the injurious wildlife list, the situations are hard to imagine. Now again, like I said, we look at the likelihood of finding some way to contain it, or perhaps just sell sterilized or triploids or something like that. Perhaps in the future, something like that can be found for a species that is listed as injurious, and we could take another look at it.
Let's pass it on to the panelists first. Anybody on the panel have a question?
Yeah, yes, I do. I mean, at least there's been talk that the listing of these constrictors was unusual in certain ways. I don't know if there were exceptions in terms of these animals were directly from the pet trade. There's a concern that they're going to spread, at least some, by modeling to outside the state of Florida, that this was not just a local issue in southern Florida, that had the potential to be a national issue. And that was part of the consideration for the listing of these animals as injurious. And there's still several other species of constrictors. There were 9 originally in the USGS report, ultimately they were recommended for listing. And then 4 got passed.
Okay. It sounds like you have several questions in there.
Yeah. So, first is, are there other examples of animals in the pet trade comparable to the Burmese pythons that have been added onto the injurious animal list?
Did you all hear the question? Okay. There, for injurious wildlife, I can't think of anything that was in trade that much when it was listed. But there were species that were in the pet trade that were listed. I think the raccoon dog was in the trade, but not yet in the United States. And the snakehead was in trade. I'm not sure whether you'd consider it pet. It was imported for food. People would keep them in aquariums. So there are examples of other species that were definitely in trade, and some for the pet industry. Perhaps the Burmese python. Okay. All right, I will do my best to project.
Here we go.
Okay, so yes, there were other species, probably nothing that was the same magnitude as the Burmese python, but that in itself is not a reason to not list something. We have to look at the threat, and we did a climate match which showed the potential to spread to other states, to other to the island territories like Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, and Guam, and all of which we have to consider. And the four species that were approved, they were approved by the Office of Management and Budget for us to list. The Office of Management and Budget is still considering the other five species. That's really all I can say. We are still considering them. We don't have approval from Office of Management and Budget yet. As far as the climate match and the potential to spread to the other states, we very clearly explained in our final rule, which if you have any questions after this session, I urge you to read the final rule. We went to great lengths to answer everything that we could. A lot of information is in that final rule, explanations about why we did what we did. And the climate match is one factor that we look at. We don't believe that climate alone is a predictor of where the potential range is to spread. And this is because we don't know if climate was a limiting factor in the native range of the Burmese python or any of the other species. It definitely plays a role, and that's why we use it. But there could be other reasons why a species in its native range only exists in a certain area and has never spread farther. It could be that there's a large physical terrain obstacle, like a mountain range or a big river, or they're on an island or it's a desert or something, obstacle that they can't get past, or a very different habitat other than where they are, and they can't survive through that habitat. In the case of the Burmese pythons, if you look at the range maps, you'll see that the northern range kind of bumps up against the foothills of the Himalayas. So that might be an indication that if the Himalayas weren't there, maybe they could spread farther north. It could be a disease in a certain area that keeps them from spreading, or they might get preyed on by some other species, or competition from another species. There are any one of a number of reasons why a species in its native range may not extend its range past where it does. And so climate match is one indicator, but it doesn't mean that the species can't spread past that climate range. So that's an important point, and the point was made in our final rule and in the proposed rule too. Did I answer all of your questions?
Yes. Now I have something to respond to. We recently published a paper on limits to the invasion of the Burmese python, based upon physiology, behavior, and which just came out a couple of weeks ago. And several of us looked at this issue and the data that has been used. And, I mean, there are three different models that have been presented so far based on climate, each giving a different distribution, depending upon the what was input into the models. Now, with the Burmese python, one issue that has been a concern is that the data was combined with the climate data with the Indian python, which is in the eastern part of the range, in quite different habitat. And from speaking to friends in India, there's no evidence of hybridization between the two. And in 1976 and 1977, the Indian python got covered by the Endangered Species Act and is no longer imported to the United States. So a distinction at that part time was made between the Burmese and Indian python. Yet in the USGS report, that climate data was combined to the two. And so to a number of people, that was an issue that really needed to be addressed. The other thing is with the Burmese pythons that are in China, in southern China, there are some outliers, or may appear to be outliers, when you look at the distribution maps that are further north in China. And from what I could tell, no one has examined those specimens to know genetically on whether they are really Molaris bivitatis or could be something else. And that from the data that has been, the little bit of DNA sequencing that has been done with the Everglades population, they appear to be pretty homogenous and more than likely came out of Thailand. They don't match up with Vietnamese, Burmese pythons that have come out of Vietnam. So there were a number of questions that were raised. Ultimately, the end result is questioning whether or not the data presented for the Burmese python in that report it really accurately is an accurate assessment. And the two coal spells that hit South Florida in 2010, there was one in January and there was one then in December of 2010. There was a fairly significant mortality of all kinds of animals, including Burmese pythons. And I don't think anyone has any data on approximately how many of those animals died at that time. So temperature seems to be a limiting factor in the ability of these animals to spread northward because they don't go in hibernaculum. They appear under cold weather to come out and try to bask, which is lethal to them if it's freezing temperatures. So they don't have the behaviors to go and use refugia so far. And so there are a number of these issues that have come up that make people question whether they're going to really invade any further north than where they are.
May I? Okay, there were a lot of questions in there. I'm going to do my best to answer, to remember all of them. I can't answer all of them. All right, let's start with the beginning, the climate match. The scientists who did the climate match were from the U.S. Geological Survey. They had their work was all peer-reviewed. I also should say much more above and beyond what was called for in the peer review process. U.S. Geological Survey, who did the risk assessment, who did the climate matching model, is not a regulatory agency. They are a science-based agency, and that's why we asked them to do it rather than us do it, because they could be more objective. They have standards for peer review that are even higher than what the Fish and Wildlife Service uses. Very, very high standards for peer review. And in fact, the risk assessment for the 9 species was peer reviewed by 20 peer reviewers. Normally, you try to get 3 peer reviewers. For our rule, we got 5 peer reviewers. Now,
All of those 20, except for two, were outside of the agency. These were independent people. These were people who signed a waiver that said that they had no involvement with this, that they were being able to be objective and independent. So let's get that out of the way. The risk assessment was highly peer-reviewed. And by the way, there was one of the comments that we received during the public comment process, I think, was that not all of the peer reviewers read the whole risk assessment. And that's perfectly understandable. You try to get reviewers who are experts in different subjects, and you're not going to get experts who are expert in every part of that assessment. So, for example, you would get a risk assessment expert. You would get people who are expert on how the risk assessment was done. You would get experts on climate matching models. You would get experts on the biology. You would get experts on the genetics and various things. And they're not going to comment on parts of the paper that they're not familiar with. So that's one thing. Let's see. So the climate match was criticized by other groups, one of which was a scientist, Alexander Pyron, who published a paper who disputed the findings of the USGS. In response to that, the three modelers from USGS published a rebuttal, and they explained everything in detail, including things like the fact that the other model used another species, used the blood python, which is a more tropical species. When you take those four points out, it doesn't emphasize the tropical as much as the northern. Other things were that people were quibbling over the exact range of the Indian python or the Burmese python, and we don't know that for a fact. So that reminds me of the subject of the taxonomy. We use the accepted terminology, which is that the Burmese python is a subspecies of Python malaris, and the Indian python is also a subspecies. So Python malaris bivitatis is the Burmese python, Python malaris is the Indian python, and yes, that one is listed as endangered by the Fish and Wildlife Service. So there has been a lot of dispute over the last 100 years over whether that should be split into two species. So far, no one has come forth with a good, valid reason. They have given some reasons, but they weren't enough to say how they would be different species. So, whether or not they could not breed together and things like that. They haven't given enough reason for that. So we are sticking with the ITIS taxonomy, Integrated Taxonomic Information System, which is generally accepted, and that has them as two subspecies of Python malaris. So, and also our USGS scientists say that it doesn't matter whether it's the Indian python or the Burmese python if you're looking at subspecies, because genetically they are similar enough. They should have the same heritable traits, that they can hibernate, and they can have the same behavioral types of traits to avoid the cold. The studies that were done in South Carolina, for example, that showed there's a loose connection here. The studies, there was one study that was done at the Savannah River Ecology Lab where 10 snakes were taken from Everglades National Park in the summer and brought to the Savannah River Ecology Lab, which is in South Carolina, and they all died in the winter. What happened there, I used to work at the Savannah River Ecology Lab, so I'm very familiar with this setup. The snakes were taken in the summer and brought much farther north, and in the paper it said that they acclimated or became, acclimatized or habituated to the northern climate. And personally, as a scientist, I don't see how that can happen. You can't take something in South Florida and bring it up to South Carolina, not pass through any mild winters, not bring it up gradually in more northern climates, just bring it up smack into winter, and then say that it's acclimated. What happened that first winter, that only winter, was that South Carolina was hit with extremely cold weather. This is the same winter that was the same record-breaking cold in South Florida. It wasn't really, really record-breaking, but it was extremely cold, very unusual for South Florida, for South Carolina. And they all did die, but Michael Dorcas, who was, I think, the senior author, said he was surprised at how long they lasted. Now, these snakes were only put in a small area, maybe 25 meters, I think it's about 25 meters long, outside. It's not a place where they could have escaped to find a more suitable refugia. And so I think it may be an indication, more like that they can survive longer than we thought they could in the cold. But it doesn't say that they can't survive if they have a chance to acclimate. And in the real world, what would happen would be succeeding generations of Burmese pythons would spread farther and farther north. The ones that survive are the ones that are the fittest ones that can adapt to the cold, either because they're just fitter or behaviorally. It doesn't follow that they're just going to fly up to South Carolina. They're going to gradually make their way up. And it may take decades, but personally as a scientist, I have no doubt that they can do it, that they can expand their range farther north and find a way. And there's something else too. There are microclimates in the United States where things can survive. There was a letter written by the Idaho Department of Fish and Game, or whatever it's called, right after our snake rule was published, that completely supported our rule, because they said they have geothermal springs in Idaho where they had alligators over winter. People were farming alligators in Idaho, and they were living outside in the winter in these geothermal areas, of which there are many out west. And they said, we don't want to take a chance that Burmese pythons can survive in Idaho. I looked into geothermal springs, and in fact, there are more than 1,600 of them across the western states, and I found that people were dumping aquarium fish into these hot springs, and they were finding all kinds of weird things. There was somebody in Utah near the Great Salt Lake where they have more salty springs, where somebody bought the land around there and dumped sharks in these springs. And then they opened it up to scuba divers and to have open water diving certification there in these springs. And you could dive in Utah with sharks. So there are microclimates all over. There are things that we haven't even thought of. So I have no doubt that eventually these snakes can find a way. They're used to being in captivity. They may find a warm spot under somebody's house. And that certainly happens. So it is possible, and we have to look at how we protect the wildlife and the interests of the public in the United States. Now, that was a long-winded answer, but there were many questions. I hope I got everything.
Yeah, I'd like to respond to that. One about the temperature sensitivity. I think the Mazzotti study is a real good one if you want to talk about and compare it to the study at Santa River Ecology, in that he had, I think there were 10 animals that were radioed, and 8 or 9 of them died, and maybe the last one was brought inside. And that's in Everglades Lakes National Park, and those are animals that had time to acclimate over the several years down there. So the together, when you look at the Mazzotti study, the study that was done in Gainesville, and the study that was done in Aiken, that these animals are susceptible to cold temperatures.
either they die outright or several of them develop a respiratory disease and die as a consequence of probably the immune system being lowered in the cold weather and then getting this respiratory infection. And so, and there's no good evidence that these animals use hibernacula. And in the USGS report, the suggested hibernacula, and I dug up as many papers as I could about skunk dens and raccoon dens and gopher tortoise burrows that potentially could be used as denning sites for these animals, and none of them are deep enough or wide enough to sustain a big python. Now, gopher tortoise burrow, and I had friends that measured Burmese pythons. We came up with maybe a 9-foot Burmese python could get into an adult gopher tortoise burrow, but nothing larger than that. And then this thing has to turn around, not only get into it, but be able to turn around at the base. So there doesn't seem to be any adequate hibernacula for these. And then in terms of animals moving forward, and being able to continue to move to adapt to colder and colder temperatures, the other reptiles in South Florida have done it to a limited extent. Iguanas have their limit, and they've been in South Florida a long time. And they reach these areas where there's several days of cold weather limits their movements. The Cuban tree frog has made it up to St. Augustine, but in that winter of 10, it got knocked back considerably. But the animals, like Anolis segrii, that have done the best at moving north, are heterogeneous. They are diverse genomically in terms of they come from a number of founder populations, diverse genetic structure. And as far as we know, the Burmese python isn't. And that diverse genetic structure has allowed certain species to move north. But with the Cuban tree frog, it appears the limit is somewhere around Jacksonville, or maybe a little bit north of that. Anolis segrii has reached its limit. So there are these limits. If there were not limits, all of these animals would have, in the wild, moved further and further north. And there were very defined limits. Now, in terms of subspecies differences, there are physiological differences between different subspecies of the same species that come from different geographies. For instance, the painted turtle. If you look at the northern and southern painted turtle, the northern painted turtle you can put under 100% nitrogen and it'll survive in hibernation. And they may have one heartbeat per day and they'll survive. Take the southern painted turtle and do that and they'll die. And so there are these very distinct physiological differences even within between subspecies of the same species because of where they're found geographically.
Okay, I can start taking some notes here so I would remember everything. Okay, first of all, you mentioned the Mazzoni study, and yes, I think 9 out of the 10 died. Again, I think that was during the record cold, and I do stress, there was a period in January of 2010 that was record cold, meaning it had never been that cold, 12 days in a row of very low temperatures. It never happened before.
No, there were times down there of freezes that were not exactly comparable, but they occur in every like 15-year cycles.
Right, but I did check the weather. I checked the National Weather Service. I checked this for the rule. I checked my facts to make sure that it was right. And the National Weather Service was saying that it was record cold for this period, which I did state in the rule what that period was. And that had never happened before. The likelihood of it happening again is pretty slim, especially considering the way temperatures are going these days. But I did want to say, after that cold front, the National Park Service at Everglades National Park found many snakes still alive. And I have in front of me the statistics from the number of snakes that have been found. And so they started in 2000. collecting snakes. And so I'm just going to start in with 2009, the year before the real cold spell. There were 367 Burmese pythons found in Everglades National Park and vicinity, including Big Cypress. In 2010, then the cold spell happened in January 2010, there were 322. That was a 10% drop. They were finding many of them well after the cold front. They were finding them, you know, reproducing hatchlings of that year and gravid females after that cold front. And then the following year, 2011, 169 were found. Now that is quite a big drop, but it still shows that at least, let's say, it's still half the number, so at least half of them may have survived. Maybe that's not a good way to judge, but anyway, there were a lot surviving, and as of the first 3 months of this year, well, up until April 9th, 50 had been found, and usually they're more active in the summer months, so I think that number is really going to go up. So the cold front did knock them back. Absolutely. We don't dispute that. But many of them survived, and it will take a little while to build this population back up again, but the ones that survived, I'm guessing, are probably either behaviorally better adapted or they're just more fit. So I think we're in for an increase in population, and the cold is not going to, we can't rely on the cold to knock them back. I know I used to live in South Florida. I worked in the Everglades for 12 years, and I had Mediterranean geckos in my house. Everybody did. I moved up to Virginia. I live in Northern Virginia now, and the town right near me, Alexandria, Mediterranean geckos have established there. In the summer, they are outside. They're all over the place. In the winter, they go inside people's houses because they adapt to houses very well. So now they're small and they can do that, but I do think that given a chance, these reptiles will try to survive any way that they can. As far as, let's see, the painted turtles, again, it seems like maybe there was not a period of acclimating for those turtles, so no, I can't speak. I don't know about that.
They were acclimated.
Okay. Did I cover everything then?
Yeah, but one thing that is important with that Everglades National Park webpage listing, and I believe it states removed. These are the number of snakes removed from the Everglades National Park for those periods of year. Now, I found that word removed interesting because it doesn't say live or dead. They don't make it, they don't distinguish between live or dead. Am I, you know, Scott, you?
To my knowledge, that's correct. And then I think they also,
so,
the area.
So, well, if you have 300 and 299 were dead, I mean, you have no idea how many that were killed by that.
Okay, they are finding hatchlings and gravid females.
Yeah, but at that number, you don't know what that number represents.
What he's saying is there's no breakdown between live animals and dead numbers. Dead animals, so it's just a number. So in terms of a data point, it's very difficult to utilize it because it's just a number. There's no, we have 100 dead ones, we have 9 live ones. That would be more of an accurate data point to be used as opposed to there were 150 snakes.
Okay, well, that's what they post, but they do have that information, and I'm sure that's available.
And
I don't speak for the Park Service.
Yeah, sure. And the other thing I heard, and I don't know, Scott probably could comment on this, someone told me they actually count eggs.
I don't know that, Elliot. I haven't heard that.
Scott does have a question for you, Sue.
Yeah, Sue, I'll try and project. Is there anything in the U.S. Code or the Code of Federal Regulations, is there anything in the Code of Federal Regulations or U.S. Code or policy that would say over what area of the United States something is deemed to be injurious and therefore qualify for a national listing? Clearly some of the, in the most recent example of the constrictor, some of them had very limited U.S. distributions. And so I wonder at what point you break it off and say, no, this really isn't a nationally injurious animal.
My voice doesn't project, so I, yeah.
The answer is no. There is nowhere in the U.S. Code that specifies. So we look at the likelihood that something can be transported to somewhere else as one issue that we look at, the likelihood that it can do harm. And so we found that we have a number of insular islands and southern areas of the country, and that that we determined that it would be in the best interest to list as injurious. Now, the states can have their own regulations, and as in Florida, they do, but many states don't, and the regulations can vary a lot, and it can get confusing to people who have snakes and who want to drive across, you know, country or something to a reptile expo. It can be confusing to them to know what the state laws are. And sometimes we get requests, like, it would be easier if we just had one law that everybody knows. So there's pros and cons, but it does make it easier if there's a federal law and everybody knows what it is.
But hypothetically, if you did a risk assessment and found that something might get established, just say, in Central Florida and South, and say Puerto Rico, for example, does that in any way mediate against the notion of a national listing in the service's eyes, or is that something that ultimately the Secretary would have to take into consideration?
Well, I guess the answer is yes to all of them. We could consider not listing if the states had something in place that would guarantee that those species would not move outside of the state. And again, it could be the Secretary's decision. Some of the snakes that we proposed to list had very small potential ranges, but we determined that the risk was great enough that we evaluated them that they needed to be listed as injurious.
Linda, I have a question for you. What is the state of Florida at a state level doing in terms of injurious species?
What we have in Florida, we have the listing is a little bit different, conditional and prohibited species. What we've done in Florida is the several of the species that are currently listed on the injurious species list, we initially started out, just to go back and give a little history, started out as listing them as reptiles of concern, putting some regulations on those particular large pythons and also the Nile monitor. And then again, with further push, if you will, and what was going on in South Florida, they were listed, moved to conditional species. So there are some specific regulations with regards to possession, housing, maintaining, things of that nature.
Florida is probably the state that's most impacted not only by injurious species, but by invasive species. Is there any idea what the total number of invasive or injurious species in Florida is right now?
No, I can't answer that question. I don't know. I'll be happy to make some calls and try to find that out.
The number of species?
Sorry?
The number of species?
The number of species.
I think it's around, well, you know.
Yeah, the total number of exotic species across the board observed at one time or another is roughly 550.
But of herps?
Of herps, it's probably closer, well, observed, I don't know, Elliot, probably 100 plus. 130, 140, established, you get down. It depends on your definition of established. It goes way down. The largest number of established herps by far in Florida is lizards.
The listing of these animals at a federal level creates a variety of different issues for people that own the animals. Of course, selling animals across state lines is problematic. But there are other issues as well. In terms of people like servicemen that are stationed in, say, California, and then they get stationed in North Carolina, and they've got a pet And now the law has made it impossible for them to move their pet back and forth. Cindy Steinle runs small-scale rescue. She has had to deal with a number of these species and a number of these issues. And she also has another issue in that in her rescue work, she's in Wisconsin, but her reptile vet for some of these species is actually in Illinois. And in her rescue work, it makes it difficult for her to transport those animals, of course, across state lines because she violates the Lacey Act to do it. Are there any plans or are there any provisions that would allow service members or rescues to move animals across state lines in that way for those issues?
Are you speaking to me?
I was speaking more to Susan because it's more of a federal issue.
Okay.
No, there are no plans. If it's a pet, it is not covered by one of our purposes for permits. I can tell you what I read on the internet, and that is that most bases around the country and around the world have restrictions on the types of pets, and it's not necessarily, and generally speaking, all kinds of exotic pets generally are not, but it also includes some dog species, or breeds, excuse me, pit bulls and things like that.
But there's provisions for those.
Okay, yeah, I'm not too familiar with it, but I'm just able to say that we don't have any plans to do anything about that.
There are provisions for the pit bulls, the Rottweilers, where you can own them, but not every service personnel lives on base. I've had, with the current Iraq situation, I've had 16 snakes with me that I moved at the beginning of March so that they were done. And these animals then had to go from the free boarding that my service provides to active military to paid boarding. I have had to euthanize animals, or actually not euthanize, kill perfectly healthy animals because I could not take them. And I know I'm not the only organization in the country. So this is almost equivalent to what California has with their ferret situation. They have it under control. Florida never got a chance before Fish and Wildlife decided, you know what, let's kill your pets, is kind of where we're sitting.
If we can save this question and ask it again in the permitting section, because in the RCACA is our permitting person,
sure.
And hopefully we can talk more about that.
Sure. Let me ask you a question that we're getting a lot since, and when I say we, I'm talking about not only kingsnake.com, but the industry itself. In terms of, what do we do with these animals now that we've got them here and we can't move them across state lines, and their value as pets becomes problematic in that they can't be moved across state lines? Is the federal government or the state government going to be setting up any type of, I'd rather not use the term euthanasia program, but any type of warehousing program for animals, exotic species that fall under that, rather than have them abandoned?
You're addressing that to me?
Both you and Linda. I'd like the federal perspective and the state perspective.
Okay. Federally, we don't really have authority per se to do anything for disposing of animals or helping them. We do, however, philosophically support, and also financially, whatever. We support Habitattitude, which is helping people to find alternatives. We support, not financially, but we want to see more pet amnesty days events happening, and we actually have had some of our people help out at those pet amnesty days, like in Florida. And so we hope that more of those will happen, and we'll do what we can to support them. And I think that's about all I can answer. So,
thank you. Yeah, in Florida, as she mentioned, we do have the pet amnesty program. We do work quite a bit with stakeholders and industry to try to find placement for animals. In the future, I see the challenges becoming when you reach those saturation points, what's going to be the outlet? Where are these animals going to go? But currently, right now, the agency has been successful through the Amnesty Day programs of placing the animals that come in that are turned in. Also working with, for example, pet shop owners, if an animal is purchased at a particular pet shop, and allowing that animal to come back and be returned to that pet shop.
What is the euthanasia rate? I'm sorry, the kill rate? And, you know, Florida has laws where you cannot get permits for new Burmese. How are you able to place them when people cannot get the permits? And to clarify what happens with some of these pet amnesty, they end up with people like me who work four jobs because these people have issues. People give up dogs and cats all the time. They give up rabbits, everything. But with the reptiles, I am the only organization type that is restricted by federal law to take my pet to the vet, to take my animal to place it. And that puts me in a very bad position. That puts me with oftentimes one option, and that is to kill the animal. If I cannot place it within the state, if it's sick and I cannot get it the treatment it needs for even a basic upper respiratory, which is fairly easy to treat, but I have to have a vet that can take care of it. I cannot take a 10-plus-foot Burmese python into, you know, any old dog or cat vet, and I also legally cannot take it to my vet. So I am forced to kill an animal that for $70 I could rehabilitate and place. So with these pet amnesty days, as you spread out, who is going to financially support them? I can guarantee it's not going to be the local humane societies. The local humane societies don't support the reptiles because they do not get funding from the reptiles all the big organizations. I'm the one who supports the reptiles in my state, and I'm the only one. And that's what the position that some of us have been put in. There are not many of us out there, and we are all self-funded. And we are being forced, because we can't do basic health care, to kill animals because of a small group of animals in Florida that can't travel anywhere else.
Okay. As far as transporting pets to a veterinarian, I understand that there are some limitations that the veterinarians have, but our regulation does not prevent you from bringing a pet to a veterinarian.
Is it legal for me to cross from Wisconsin to Illinois to a reptile specialist veterinarian?
No.
There you go.
But I'm saying that you can find one within the state, and if there aren't any, perhaps you should be speaking to the veterinarians.
The reptile veterinary field is very new.
Yeah.
And I am not going to go to a first-year veterinarian who has never dealt with a 14-foot Burmese python.
Well,
and who doesn't treat them.
Considering the pet trade in reptiles is growing so much, I still think
it's
might
a
be
very new field. But at this point, okay, my current veterinarian is in Mundelein, Illinois. I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Is it legal for me to take a Burmese python or a yellow anaconda to the vet?
Not across state lines.
Is there a way that we can look at developing, I guess this is probably a better question for Amneris as well, is there a way to look at developing a permit system for rescues in that place? And like I said, that's probably a better question for
Amneris. Please wait for that one.
Most states now have veterinarians that have some experience with these animals. The Association of Reptile Amphibian Veterinarians has on their website, I think they are going to have, or it's already up, a listing by state of capable veterinarians.
But it is still one of the biggest issues that I run into is it's a small field. Many vets can treat a bearded dragon, but a lot of them will hesitate if you call and say you have a 14-foot Burmese.
At least not the people who consistently go to this meeting and who spend. There's a meeting next month, their annual meeting. There are more today than ever before.
Oh, yeah.
The organization started in the early 90s, and there were a number of veterinarians even before that interested. So there are several hundred in the U.S. right now that consider themselves very capable of working on a range of size of reptiles. So I don't. In Wisconsin, I would expect that there are some. I know the people
there are four active that regularly take continuing education. Wisconsin does not have a specialty, but I know of one who will see a large python. And I actively check and keep track of that. And only one will actively see a large, or even a crocodilian or a large monitor lizard for that matter.
We've got about 15 minutes left for this panel. I know the audience has a few questions, so I'd like to give them an opportunity to ask some. Mark Cantos appears to have a question. Before you use this flare gun, because I know we've got a flare gun. And
a couple of things really fast. In regard to the program that Scott developed and implemented, there's a large retailer on the other coast of Florida, on the West Coast or on the East Coast, and they went through all the paperwork, and it was a lot. But they were able to rescue pythons, Burmese pythons, and some of our restricted species, and then turn around and find them good homes. The concept of one man's trash is another man's treasure is exactly that. And business people are willing to insert themselves and go through the work, and there was a lot of work. I think their office manager put over 40 hours into satisfying Florida Fish and Game, because Florida Fish and Game wanted to make sure it wasn't just a sloppy turnaround operation, and that makes sense. Unfortunately, once this listing went into effect federally, there went that market. I do the turtle source. I don't participate in the rescue directly. I need to, but a lot of people that get some turtles and tortoises, get them to me, and then I turn around and find homes for them. Sometimes it's part of business, and sometimes it's just part of doing the right thing. But the question that I had originally, I was just speaking to the last part of the discussion, the question I had originally was that in the grand scheme of things, I think in a way the service looks at it from the bottom up. Restrictive species, this is injurious, this is invasive. I called in on an NPR panel about a year and a half ago. My local NPR station had a panel. Scott may have been on it, but it was a bunch of experts, large government agencies from all around the country, speaking to invasive species. And my point was, of course, responsible ownership, responsible industry is key. But in the big picture, considering climate change, considering immigration, legal and illegal, considering commerce, considering the tens of thousands of giant cargo containers that come back and forth, considering everything, and considering that the service's approach so far in a lot of ways is really just been closing the barn door after the cows have gotten out, everything, zebra mussels, sparrows, I'm trying to remember some of the other ones that were there, walking catfish, but there are a lot of other examples, and also mammals. Pretty much everything will have an opportunity to be everywhere at some point within reason. And I think in a way, damage control is more or less going to have to be looked at from the top down. If everything can be everywhere, are we really looking at that as possibly? Is the service looking at that? I know the state of Florida looks at it that way, but I don't know if the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does. Thank you.
Well, I can answer a little bit of that.
PJAC is working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service now to develop a protocol to determine the likelihood of a species becoming invasive. And there are mathematical calculations and data sets that you can actually use to do this. They're doing it with fish, and they will expand it to reptiles and amphibians at some point. So I think that we are looking towards it, both the Fish and Wildlife Service and the industry is looking towards a way to stop the problem before it's already out the barn door problem. Does that help us with the Burmese python? Probably not. I think that's one of the more positive things that's come out of the whole Burmese python thing is that PJAC has interfaced with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to develop this program to determine what the potential for an animal becoming injurious or invasive would be. And that, of course, has got to be step one. Of course, it'll be really frightening if it comes back and says 99% of the species we're bringing in have a good chance. But I don't think that's ever going to pass, because I think the data sets are going to prove it out. But that's certainly one good working example now today of what we've got going on, that PJAC program. And I was really surprised. One of the bones of contention I've always had with PJAC is they're not very vocal about the things that they do when they do stuff for the industry. They don't go out and wave flags and trumpet it and put out press releases. PJAC does a lot of stuff that you don't hear about. I was completely unaware of that they were even involved in this until this spring when Marshall told me, well, gosh, we've already got this program. We're working with Fish and Wildlife. We think we've got a good key on it. So I was shocked, and I was even more shocked to find out that they've been working on it for several years. So I think it's a really good first step, but once again, it's the first step. And it's the first step to closing the door before the horses get out the door. Sue, do you want to add to that at all? Or?
Yeah, I'll just try to do it from here. Yes, I thank you for that. It is true, we have been working with Marshall Myers of PJAC. We have been telling other groups about it, and we've been giving presentations about it. So small groups have been hearing about it. It hasn't been widely publicized yet because we're working on a memorandum of understanding between the Fish and Wildlife Service and PJAC and hopefully AFWA, Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, and hopefully other groups will sign on too. That hasn't been completed yet. It's going under many layers of review. I had no idea it was going to take this long to review it. We've had all kinds of solicitors and attorneys looking in on it to make sure nobody got thrown into jail for something. But anyway, so that's why there hasn't been a big announcement about it yet, but hopefully the industry, PJAC, will make a big announcement. We're counting on it. But to answer your question, there are other ways of looking at it, which we are doing, and what we need to focus more on are the pathways of these invasive species getting into the United States. The big picture, how do we keep things from being imported that shouldn't be, and we have presentations later on importations, but the Fish and Wildlife Service is involved in, let's say, the Aquatic Nuisance Species Task Force, which is looking at ballast water. Many more things are coming in from ballast water than probably the pet trade. So we have to look at how to stop unwanted things, unintentional hitchhikers from coming in, and we are looking at that.
Like I said earlier, I spoke in on this radio show, and the moderator said, when I said that, he said, I'm looking around the room, and everybody in the room is nodding their head in agreement that everything will be everywhere. And so, are you looking at the fact that the pet industry is out of the picture, out of the equation entirely, still, you still will eventually, through travel and commerce, you still will have every animal having an opportunity to establish itself everywhere, essentially on the planet. I mean, maybe not Komodo dragons, but certainly every gecko species, and so on and so forth. So, looking at it from the top down, I mean, almost in a way, we're almost a good guinea pig to give you ideas of what you're going to face and what will happen, because when it happens on a grander scale, or it happens unexpectedly, and nobody's monitoring, because there is none, it's not because of the pet trade, maybe because of agriculture and plants coming in. Now, are you looking at it that way? Because if not, I mean, that seems to be the way to look, because all the past examples are past, and the barn door is really closed too late on this.
Well, I agree. Eventually, it'll be one big world, and there will be new species all over the place. What we're trying to do is stave that off as much as we can with the limited resources that we have, very limited resources that we have at the Fish and Wildlife Service. We're doing the best that we can, but we're looking at it from several different ways. We're doing the listings. We're working with the industries that import live animals. We're looking at the pathways. We're doing what we can.
Is there much work being done with domestic feral animals and the impact that they're having on our native wildlife?
Cats.
Okay, the question is there anything being done on domesticated feral animals? And actually, that is not under the authority of the injurious wildlife provisions. It specifies wild mammals and wild birds. So we are not looking at feral pigs or cats. Now, there are other parts of the Fish and Wildlife Service that may be, for example, the refuge system may be looking at, and they are definitely looking at feral pigs and maybe cats. I don't know about that, but I know they're looking at feral pigs on refuge lands. So that's
can those animals, if someone wanted to move them onto your jurisdiction, and have them listed or potentially inclusive, having, you know, secondary feral animals or basically wild animals, domesticated wild animals. But when you look at the numbers and the impact, that if they're going to, the bucket's just being kicked down the road to someone else, those two groups of animals, something needs to be done with. In Florida, there are about 8 million feral cats. And every cat that kills something doesn't eat it.
We know that that's a problem. No doubt about that. Feral pigs, feral cats, and a lot of other domesticated animals gone wild are problems. We don't have the jurisdiction to list domesticated species. Even if we did, do you...
You're going to
realistically think it would get through? We had a lot of trouble getting Burmese pythons through, which are not nearly the magnitude right now that domesticated cats are, feral cats. So, yeah, realistically, I don't think it would happen. We are trying to prevent things like the Burmese pythons from ever getting to the magnitude of the feral cats.
We've got time for one more question from the audience before we take a break and then split off. Let's go ahead and give it right here to Gina.
Oh, I don't need this. All right. I do reptile rescue in Houston here. And the number of birds and retics and even rock pythons that I've gotten in that are sick because either the owners don't know what they're doing and they don't keep the temperature to the humidity correct levels, or they've been loose in the wild, those guys can't survive here. And they can't survive in people's homes if they don't do it right. And the ones who come in, they're aware of the wild, they're sick. I have a pretty good survival rate on them because I get them on Bantrol and I jack up the temperature and give them a little mini swimming pools and all that stuff. And then I work on trying to place them. And I also get in one that's found in the middle of winter that fall out of a tree and they're black. And they bring them into me and you warm them up and you get them on Bantrol and they come back to life. But they wouldn't have survived if they would have stayed out there or they would have been eaten by something. So I don't see much of a possibility of those guys surviving in Houston in our ventures at all. I also take in on small-scale hedgehogs. Hedgehogs are illegal in like 9 of the other states in the United States. And I just got one delivered to me yesterday because a person is moving to one of those states that they're illegal in. I don't understand why we just can't take, like gerbils are illegal in certain states, ferrets are illegal in certain states, and there are a whole bunch of other pets because they could become, they could integrate in with the ecosystem there. Why can't it just be done on a total state-by-state basis? And we don't have this issue. The pets that can survive in the areas that they can survive, they just become legal in those areas, in those states. The Burmese should be illegal in Florida. I don't have an issue with that. But having them illegal in Houston or in Texas where they're not going to survive, or in Idaho, I've lived 12 years in northern Idaho and Rocky Mountains, and there is no freaking way that those guys are going to survive there. I guarantee you. So I just don't understand why it can't be done on a state-by-state basis.
To a certain extent, it is. I mean, states have what's called states' rights. They have the ability to set their own laws and regulations and rules, and they do. Florida is a perfect example of that. They've got their own rules and regulations, Texas as well. But there are times when the federal government has to get involved. You know, the problem is when the federal government gets involved, it's generally a nationwide thing. They don't generally operate on a state-by-state basis in those terms. That either good or bad, I don't know. Maybe it's something we need to look at.
The federal government didn't outlaw hedgehogs. You know, my state did.
Yeah. Right, but if the federal government did take action on hedgehogs, they probably would have no other option but to do it nationwide, simply because that is how they work. They're mandated to work at a federal level. Agreed.
Well, and it should have. There was very little time between the ROC listing and the federal listing to see if the Florida's laws would clear up the situation. There was not enough acclimation, so to speak, to allow that law to actively take effect, to change the impact, and to see if it was going to continue to be a situation. It just became a federal issue with very little notice.
Well, we actually had been working on it since 2006 when we got the petition. We put out the notice of inquiry in 2008, so everybody had a good idea.
Well, there was that time between it, but at the same time, Florida was pushing for its own laws, getting their own laws in place, and between Florida's laws going active, banning the ownership and prohibiting new animals, to the point of the federal listing, there was not a lot of time in place to see if Florida could clean up the situation on its own before the federal government said too slow.
Well, okay, but there are other states involved, and they may or may not have been working on it. So we do have to look at all the states, and there are several things I want to cover here. One is first directly about your comment about these animals coming into you because they're sick, because people can't even keep them in captivity. Well, one thing that we look at is something that we call propagule pressure, or another way of putting it is release events. The more individuals that you have that can be dumped into the wild or released into the wild, the greater the likelihood that one of those or more of those is going to survive. And so if we, and granted, they won't all survive. Granted, some of them were dumped because they were sick and they're going to die. Those sick ones, though, may actually transmit a disease to our native snakes. So we still don't want that. And the more of those that are dumped, the greater the likelihood, or the more that are imported, however you look at it, the more that are involved that can be released into the environment, the greater the likelihood one or more of them is going to be strong enough to survive. And if you get enough of them, you may eventually have an established population. As far as having states do their own regulations, that's fine. In fact, there are many states that do that. There are states that have more stringent regulations than we do. And in fact, in Florida, possession is now prohibited for the general public, not for breeders. But then if Georgia doesn't do something, then the snakes can get exported to Georgia by the breeders. So it really gets this patchwork of laws that makes it very hard for law enforcement. And because this is a law enforcement question with the states, I would like to hold this question and have more of an answer, this question brought up later for the panel, representatives from law enforcement to answer.